can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man.
Welcome back, everybody. Mike's a little bit loud. That's because it's the last show. It's the Temple of Swan at radio.dominican.edu. Temple and I are a little bit sad that we're finishing it out. We're going to try to do it with a bang. A lot to talk about, including some disappointing losses by the Sharks. Dubs face elimination. We'll get into A's Giants, and we're definitely going to touch on what Mr. Sterling had to say and what the NBA cracked down on. It's next at the Temple of Swan.
This is the Temple of Swan at radio.dominican.edu, wrapping up our first year as MCs on the mic. And we did already touch to this, but we did sign a contract for next year with radio incentives.
Inked it down.
It's a one-year deal with max incentives if we attend spring training and go through all the voluntary workouts.
Bonuses if it's quality?
Of course.
Sweet.
Player incentives if we get 6 buzzer-beating calls for basketball.
Oh, man.
I don't know. I don't know what else I could
think of. Dude, just imagine what our voices would sound like if that happened. We'd be hoarse.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome, though.
A lot of overtime games.
Oh.
But yeah, this is our last show, and we just want to start it off talking about the Sharks and how they blew another playoff series. This one of the more heartbreaking fashion, up 3-0, playing probably the best hockey they have all season. And then losing 4-3 with a 5-1 loss in Game 7 at home.
I just want to ask you, after they went up 3-0, did you think there is any doubt in your mind that they would not advance?
Yeah, the way they were playing, I thought this was going to be a 6-game series at the most. I thought they were going to win it in 5, to tell you the truth, because we were on air and we were like, the worst the Sharks can do is lose that game 4, but then come back and win Game 5 at home and end the series, because they were just being dominant, scoring on quick, playing great defense. But that didn't happen. They got whooped. Game 4, Game 5 wasn't any closer. Game 6, it looked decent, but you could see the momentum start to change. And in Game 7, from the middle of the second period on, it was donezo for the Sharkies.
And what I want to know is, after 3 games, Burns disappeared a little bit. Everyone's kind of putting the heat on Patty and Joe, which I can understand, they're making the big bucks, but what happened to the guys on the blue line?
Yeah.
They kind of disappeared, and all of a sudden, here comes Jonathan Quick, and you see teams in the NHL throughout the playoffs ride their goaltender, and that's what the Kings were able to do. Also, I didn't think the officiating helped at all the last 2 games.
Yeah. The Sharks, that's one thing.
But you got to capitalize on power plays, yeah, bottom line.
The Sharks got plenty of opportunities. They didn't take care of what they needed to. We knew that coming into the series, they weren't going to score a lot of goals on quick. The first 3 games were kind of an aberration for what this series is really supposed to look like. And then we saw what Quick can do in the last 4 games. Shut down the Sharks' offense. They, even when they were getting good looks, they weren't capitalizing and finishing. Quick took away all the momentum from the series. And the Sharks had to come in thinking that they're only going to win these games 2-1. Or maybe even 3-2 max, but you cannot give up 5 goals and expect to beat the Kings.
Not at all. And they faded.
Yeah.
It's coming down to typical Shark playoff hockey. And we were both in agreement that this was kind of the turning point this season, especially after they jumped out 3-0. But now, we can talk a little bit about Game 7. I want to start with the replay, the goal that was reviewed. Did you think that was a goal?
Me being a Sharks fan and biased as they come, I think so. I mean, it could have gone either way, especially with the Sharks. They kind of needed that goal to get started and to get kick booted. Didn't go their way, but I mean, I know that you had stronger feelings because you were texting me about the goal. Do you think it should have been allowed?
I did, and it was kind of one of those goals where Quick caught it in his glove behind the line, but it wasn't conclusive enough to give him the goal, so they ruled it no goal, and I felt a little bit of momentum shifted from there. But any time the Sharks dominated that second period, and they were just putting shots on the Kings and the Quick, and they had multiple power plays to no avail. Can't win like that.
Yeah, and that save that he made on Patty Marleau, Jonathan Quick, was probably one of the best saves in the series.
Is that where you just tip your cap and
yeah,
you realize this isn't ours?
And that's what the Sharks have had to do against Quick for most of their times playing against him, because Quick has taken away so many what seems like goals that the Sharks should have already knotted on the scoreboard. But Quick takes them away, and it really frustrated the Sharks. And we saw on the power plays, they had two good chances in the second period to really go up 2-0 and put this game away, but they couldn't capitalize on the power plays. And then you see the Kings, when they get on the power play, they took advantage by getting two goals on their man advantage. So the Kings did what they had to do to come back, but the Sharks shouldn't have let it get that deep in the first place. The most that you can go when you're up 3-0, the most you want to go is game five, especially with home ice.
Even if it goes to 7, the worst case scenario that it did, and they couldn't close out, you have game 5, game 7 at home, 2 out of 3. You can't get it done. So what happens now in-house with management? Because this is a huge flurry now with all the talent that the Sharks had. They were running 3 great lines, 4th line, and a lot of bruisers and guys that could hit. I thought that was a great combination for McClellan. Now, where do you go? He's been there 6 seasons.
Yeah.
Do you keep him around? Because I think he's a great coach. But it's starting to add up to they can't win in the playoffs.
Yeah, you can't lose in the first round when you're such a good team like the Sharks were the whole season. And they've done this time and time again. The Sharks will be one of the best teams throughout the regular season, but when they get into the postseason, they just can't seem to get over that hump. I mean, 2 years ago, I believe it was, when they made it to the 3rd round Western Conference Finals, that's like the deepest they've gone. But since then, it's usually a first or second round exit, and the Sharks are way too good of a team and way too deep of a team. They're, like you said, lines 1 through 4, they're probably the best team in the NHL. They're deep, got a lot of scores on each of their lines, and they got bruisers that you need to compete in the playoffs, but yet they still can't get it done. So something has to change. I don't know if it's within the coaching staff or if it's from the GM himself, but the Sharks really have no more excuses to their fans and to their players of themselves that they can't win in the playoffs.
That's a huge point, because fans, you know, with the community, especially with the team, they demand change, especially after this nightmare collapse. I don't think any true Sharks fans were expecting this whatsoever, so now they're going to demand change. I don't think you need to change anything within the lines that the players have. Their talent is there. It's evident. They do it day in and day out, year in, year out in the regular season. So maybe there is a change in the coaching staff or general manager. I asked you this earlier when I heard Bucher say this. He had sources from north of the border, he's calling it, I guess somewhat reliable, that they're cleaning house. Goodbye coaching staff, goodbye McClellan, goodbye general manager. Is that a smart idea, or is that too much of a overreaction?
I think either way they're not going to go wrong. I mean, if they decide to keep McClellan and the GM, then it's
continuous right now. What do you,
well, I don't know what it is, but anyways, the continuity, that's the word looking for. Nice. I had to come at it from a different angle.
Got it.
The continuity will be there, and like you said, he's coached already 6 seasons. Yeah, he hasn't got over that final hump, but he's gotten the Sharks to the playoffs each year, and they've looked like they could be the team to beat in probably each one of those seasons. So, I mean, you know he's a good coach and capable. It's just, can he get over that hump and win a playoff series that is crucial? Because this was against your rival in the Kings. You know that the players were playing hard. You know that they're giving it everything they got. So you've got to end up winning this series, especially when you go up 3 games to nothing. But, I mean, if they do fire him and they do get rid of the GM, then
fans are probably happy.
There's a good reason for that, too, because they're the second longest active streak with making the playoffs behind the Detroit Red Wings. So, I mean, they've been there year in, year out. They just can't get those wins when they need them. So, if you're going to get rid of them, then, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with that either. As long as you have a suitable replacement that can really take the next step and win you a championship.
I hear you. And I wonder if the pressure is kind of building. They're the only team in California no Stanley Cup win.
Yeah.
So.
They're the quest for one. And I think what the Sharks need, especially in the offseason, is, they are getting older with Joe Thornton and Patty Marleau and guys of that nature, but they do have good young stars like Couture, like Pavelski, like Vlasic. I think the Sharks need an extra D-man because when Vlasic went down, they were really thin on the defensive pairings. But I think so if they get another like top five defenseman, the Sharks can be really dangerous because they've got the money, they got the weapons they can to go out and get one. So I think if the Sharks can end up pulling that off, be a very dangerous team because I think they just need one more defenseman to really round out the crew. I don't think they need to get rid of Thornton or get rid of Marleau because that's not the answer. Those guys played good this series, well, at least the first three games, and then kind of tapered off a little bit. We lost the scoring from them, but those guys are not the problem. I think they just need that one more piece to hopefully do it next year. I mean, you keep saying the same thing every year, but that's my opinion.
I agree. That's all they need. Shape it up with the defenseman on the blue lines.
You agree?
Yeah. Dubs?
Dubs. Let's talk Dubs.
Huge game tonight.
Game six. Hopefully not the eliminating game for the Warriors. They've got to get it done tonight at Oracle.
Tell them the stat. Tell our listeners the stat about the elimination games.
You told me this stat, so I thought you'd deliver it. I'll give you the honor.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Well, Dubs are 0-7 in elimination games. So I'm thinking it might be opposite day. We had a historic meltdown last night, so maybe, you know, history's starting to change a little bit.
Or you could be of the nature that, they haven't done it the previous seven. What makes this any different? I mean, the Warriors have played so inconsistently in this series, and yet they're only down 3-2 with a chance to even it up and go back to L.A. for game seven. You've got to be happy with where you're standing, even though you're down a game, because you know that the Warriors haven't really played their most complete game to date. I mean, game five was pretty nice from the Warriors' standpoint because they jumped out to that huge lead. They were making threes, but they started tapering off at the end. I think the Warriors, if they can put it all together tonight, which they need to do because the Clippers are going to come out guns a-blazing trying to eliminate them on their home court, then the Warriors can get it done.
Two things here. One, if they eliminate the turnovers, are the Warriors a better basketball team than the Clippers? That's my first question. And two, what if Klay Thompson played the role, I'm not talking what Iguodala's doing, but how, where Iggy is on the floor and when he handles the ball and someone will bring a screen for Iggy and you have Klay on the wing and Curry on the wing, what happens if Klay plays that role? Yes, he might turn it over if he's getting doubled. What changes here for game five?
Well,
for game six,
Curry needs to take better care of the rock. I think he had 7 turnovers by himself last game, which is inexcusable for a point guard. But, I mean, the Clippers are, like you're saying, they're double-teaming. They're creating havoc on him right when he passes mid-court. So a strategy that could be in Mark Jackson's repertoire here is either bringing Iguodala at the point or Klay Thompson and let Curry work off some screens. But then even when we saw that last game, I was watching Curry when he was off-ball. They're still double-teaming him when he's running off those three screens in a row, and they're right with him. He's got no room to operate right now.
Yeah, and that is smart if you are the Clippers and Doc Rivers. But main point, if they cut down on the turnovers, save a couple more possessions, I thought the Warriors had their run made at the end of the third, and then when it jumped into the fourth, when they cut it to 3, 80-41, I thought that maybe they had the chance to, you know, steal this one on the road in L.A., but just turnovers kept biting them in the, you know what.
Yeah, and they got up by 1 after that Curry 3, and I thought that was, like you said, when they were going to really take control of the game, but then Clippers come back and score 5 straight points, and really the lead was just buoying from 7 to 5 points the whole game, and the Warriors couldn't get back to where they had the lead. And that was because of turnovers. They weren't taking care of the ball. The Warriors need to make sure that they do that, because I remember hearing on the telecast that the Warriors haven't beaten the Clippers when their turnover margin is in the negative. So if the Warriors win the turnover battle, they beat the Clippers, but if they lose the turnover battle, they lose to the Clippers. And that's happened in all of the games this year. So that really tells you all you need to know. If the Warriors
that's
take
bottom
care,
line.
Yeah, the Warriors take care of the ball, they have a very good chance of beating the Clippers, whether it be at home or away, because they've proven that they could do it at both places.
So there's a huge impact, would you say, with Donald Sterling gone. I flipped over to TNT to watch the pregame, and what that stadium and arena put on was nuts. Because I didn't know if Comcast Sports Bay Area was going to show that, so I just wanted to see what was going on pregame, and that they went off. And so there's a couple guys in the studio that said Warriors had no chance of winning this game, and they fought a lot harder and stayed in the game a lot better than I thought, handling how Sterling got bounced and how that just whole community just rallied and fans rallied around that team. I mean, how are you going to win after that? That's a huge mob supporting the Clippers that, like they have in a greater sense through this whole series.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of articles talking about how the Warriors are just a pawn in a bigger story right now. The Clippers are what everyone's following because of the Sterling issue and the Sterling news that he made. So I think that the Warriors really haven't gotten too much attention. They haven't gotten the news talk. The Clippers are playing for something much bigger. It's kind of like a plot to a movie right now, and the Warriors are just that other team that gets no attention. So like you said, I wasn't thinking that the Warriors were going to be able to hang in game five on the road against the Clippers after Sterling was banned from the NBA for life, because that was a huge message sent from Silver down to the Clippers community and the Clippers team themselves,
and just like the whole country,
yeah,
to stand behind and say we don't want any part of that,
yeah, and then,
especially the owners, we don't want any part of that.
And then unfortunately, it was the day of the game in which the Warriors were tied 2-2 in the series, looking for a huge win. I mean, like you said, they played very well, they hung in there. They just couldn't get it back down to one possession. They were just booing between 5 and 7 points, like I said earlier. So, I mean, the starters did play a lot of minutes. That was one thing that I noticed. But if the Warriors can just take care of the ball, make some shots, this is going to be a much different game, and I don't see how the Warriors can lose it. They're on their home court, and I heard that the crowd in Game 4 was the best it's been all season and looked like it was last postseason. So if the crowd comes with the same energy they did in Game 4, then I think that the Warriors really should have no excuse to lose this game. I think that they're just as good as the Clippers, if not better, when they take care of the ball.
I agree. If they emulate that, I think they get the W. If you look how the Dubs have played on their home court, they've been in every game. They had a valid chance to win Game 3. They came all the way back. If they start better, if they hit, I don't know, let's say 4 more threes, because I don't know, what was the stat? They were into the fourth quarter 1 for 18 from downtown or something like that. If it's a new ball game, if there's an arguable foul call on the last play on Chris Paul, Dubs have won that game. So I don't think there's any chance that if the Warriors come out, play their ball, Clippers can match the intensity, but I think the ceiling is going to be higher for the Dubs tonight. I think they get the W. Also, what do you think Mark Jackson is feeling right now? Does he think in his mind that this could possibly be the last game he coaches for the Warriors?
Yeah, and I think the players know that as well. I think they're all playing with that kind of chip on their shoulder that this could be their last time together as players and coaches on the same team. Because Mark Jackson's definitely coaching for his job. I mean, I don't know that for a fact because I don't have personal conversations with Joe Lacob, but from all the news and all the media attention that this situation has been getting, I have to believe some of it's true, and Coach Jackson needs to take that next step and get to either the second or third round to really prove that he's a legitimate coach. So I know that he's definitely feeling the pressure in this game alone to make it go 7, because if he doesn't get it to game 7, then it's really, I think, seen as a failed season, and Mark Jackson really can't afford a failed season with the kind of leash that he has given from Lacob.
Does he, if it comes to this, DeAndre Jordan's been making a lot more free throws, a heck of a lot more free throws than I thought he was going to make in this series. Do you continue to hack if you have to late in games or late in the half? And can they let Draymond play physical with Griffin as Griffin plays physical with Draymond. It seems like they call some tacky fouls when Draymond is playing hard D. And they're going to have – Griffin's a – he just is a bull.
And Griffin initiates the contact every most time. Of the time. And Draymond Green's hands will be straight up, and he'll get the foul called because they're seen as him being the more aggressive player on defense.
When standing
really,
his ground.
Yeah, when really it's Griffin trying to bowl him over, but Draymond stands so tall and so strong that he's not going to get knocked over, but yet he's getting a foul called on it. I've also seen that during the series.
They got to let him play.
Yeah, tonight. When Draymond's gotten in foul trouble, the Warriors have definitely suffered because they're having to bring in Mo Spates to control both Griffin and Jordan, and Mo Spates is not the defensive player that can really take that task and do a good job at it. Draymond Green, though he is undersized, plays very good defense. He's a hard rebounder, and he'll battle every time down on the defensive side of the court. So they need him to get out of foul
absolutely. Trouble. Absolutely. The quickness between Draymond and Spates is hands down. Green's got great quickness, and he can stay with Griffin because he's a quick big. And he's strong enough, yeah, like he's a little undersized, but he's definitely strong enough to bang with him. And so I want to see the refs let him play. No ticky-tack fouls because that kills the Warriors. And we saw a break in foul trouble last game. I thought maybe that was a huge momentum swing, him picking up four. If he gets in foul trouble tonight, there's no way DeAndre Jordan has a game like he did last.
Yeah, so, DeAndre Jordan played his best game of his career last time out. I don't see him replicating that here in game six. It's just they need Draymond to stay out of foul trouble. They need Klay to stay out of foul trouble. Andre Iguodala needs to keep playing good because I think he's been one of the hidden heroes of this series. He's taken the offensive side of the ball very seriously, and he's scoring on isolation plays now. Ever since game two, Andre Iguodala has stepped up.
And more hesitation.
Yeah, and played both great offensively and defensively. So if he keeps playing the way he is, it's a lot of ifs, but I think that the Warriors can really piece it together because they need to in game six, and they're at their home court. Jermaine O'Neal, I think, is playing a decent series as well. Draymond Green's got to stay out of foul trouble, and Stephen Curry's not needs to not turn the ball over. Those are the two main points.
Those are perfect keys of game right there. Yeah. Perfect. You hit it on all cylinders. If they win tonight, I tell you that Clippers are going to have some pressure for game seven. Warriors are not going to have any.
That's a very good point. Because of all the media surrounding the Clippers are the higher seed. They're expected to go to the championship this year and compete in the West. And the Warriors have really, though they had high expectations before the season, really none of that is being made newsworthy now.
With all the media hype.
The Warriors are expected to be a good and battling team in the West, like every team in the West is, but they're not really expected to take that next step and get to the Western Conference Finals. So I like that point that you bring up. If they win this game and force a Game 7, all of the pressure is put on the Clippers' back, and it's going to be interesting to see how they react because Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, Chris Paul, who knows what they can do in a pressure Game 7 at home when they're expected to win.
And they don't want that. And you see so many teams fight incredibly hard to close out on the road. You want to get the series over with. And when you don't do that, and if it takes that much of a toll out of you to think about, all right, now we're going home. That's great. We got home court. But now we're coming off a loss. We've got a rebound. This team's coming into our building that just won. We exerted all this energy to try to close out on the road. Now we got to exert the same amount, if not more, to try to close out on our home floor coming off a loss.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge... If Dubs win tonight, it's that seven is going to be something that the Clippers are really going to have to wake up for, which they will. But
yeah.
Anything that goes wrong could derail them.
And the one saving grace, I think, for the Warriors is their ability to shoot the three ball. If you can win game six, you don't really have to shoot it great in game six. Just take care of the ball. Don't commit fouls. And you should be able to maybe get a nice 1-2-point victory in game six. But game seven, I think the huge X factor will be the three-point shot. Klay Thompson, Iguodala, and Curry are going to have to make three-pointers because you know the Clippers are going to come out and try to bang you from the inside. And if you can counter that with threes of your own and you're actually making three-point shots, that takes the crowd out of the game. That takes the Clippers out of the game. And I think that's the huge X factor because the Warriors can shoot the three and have that kind of ability to take over a game from beyond the arc, which could be the X factor in game seven.
If that's the strategy, then I think you almost, you go at Griffin as hard as you can. You send your doubles when you want. But this team seems to just go off when Jamal Crawford is hitting. He is just like a train that you can't stop if he's rolling. And so he's hitting from outside, inside. You got to there's help D coming from all angles when Crawford's penetrating. If you can hit the threes if you're the Warriors and then contain Crawford and Paul, and you don't say let the bigs just go to work, but if that's two versus three. If you start canning threes and Griffin and starts getting his inside and DeAndre Jordan's going to have his offensive rebound putbacks, if you contain the perimeter, you could win. And why not go out guns blazing like that if you're the Warriors?
Live or die just by go the three. For it. Exactly. Live or die by the three. And I would definitely trade a three-pointer for a two-pointer. If you're saying Clippers are going to go down.
That creates panic.
Exactly.
A little bit.
And get Griffin a two-pointer, I'll definitely trade that for a Curry three-pointer on the opposite end, maybe on a fast break or whatever it be. So I think that's could be an X factor in Game 7. But first, you've got to win Game 6 tonight.
Absolutely.
Nationally televised game in front of Oracle. You said they're going to win? Are you sticking with that prediction tonight?
Yeah, and
last time you predicted a 14-point win.
I'm not going to say the score. I will say, though, if I had $2,000 plus a dollar.
$2,000 plus a dollar.
I'd put that down on the Warriors tonight.
Just letting the listeners know, he put $2,000 on the Sharks last night. So I don't know how confident that I would be in that bet.
We talked about that game night for the Sharks. I said, you know what, Temple? If I had $2,000 right now, I'd throw it on the Sharks. So right now, I'm $2,000 in the hole. So that's why I'm betting $2,000 and a dollar.
On the Warriors tonight.
And you know what? That's a house payment. So if it doesn't go well, I'm $4,000 and a buck in the hole and going home with a sad face and a foot in my bucket.
So the Warriors better win. And when we come back at the Temple of Swan, we'll get to some baseball talk at radio.dominican.edu. Welcome back to the Temple of Swan at radio.dominican.edu, our last show of the year, and we will be resuming back in August when the fall 2014 semester takes place. But right now, we're going to talk about some A's baseball, and when we left you guys last week, the A's were getting ready for a Texas road trip. They had 4 in Houston, then 3 at Texas, and we talked about maybe taking a sweep in Houston or 3 games and then getting 2 in Texas would be a successful one, but kind of the opposite story. They took the first 2 in Houston, then surprisingly lost back-to-back games against the Astros, 7-6 and 5-1. But then in a huge rematch against the Texas Rangers, tied for first place in the AL West, the A's ended up sweeping the Rangers, all in convincing fashion in my mind, which still I think is a very positive road trip when you go 5-2 in Texas. What were your thoughts, just off the bat, initial thoughts of the A's road trip?
I'll start from the beginning. Two games in Houston, they put up 10-12, dominated them. I thought, okay, they'd take three or probably sweep. They did not. So going into Texas, I was like, how's the morale going to be after losing the final two games of the Houston series? And, dude, Sonny Gray just set the tone. CG, shutout, shut him down. It seems every time Darvish takes a mound against the A's, the A's have his number. He's got nightmares thinking about the whole 1-9 of the A's hitters. And then you had Kazmir come in. He also goes fairly deep, pitches well. Another win, tack on 9. But then we see what happened yesterday. Jay Chov, the unsung hero. My favorite pitcher right now on the staff. As you were raving about him before the season, I got to keep giving you credit because he's just taken off, and now everybody's starting to know about him. And you were right, convincing fashion, blowout city. Rangers didn't really stand a chance, and do you got to be thinking if you're the Rangers? Well, I don't know. They did take the sweep in the Coliseum, but they could have lost too. Are the Rangers, I want to say,
the A's
not as good as the Oakland A's?
The A's are the better team.
Okay.
From watching both squads, I mean, the Rangers have lost 4 in a row. They lost one before this 3-game sweep. But I think the A's are a better team just because of their pitching depth. You see that they threw out Gray, Kazmir, Chavez, their three best pitchers, and they dominated the Ranger lineup, only giving up 4 runs in 3 games. And then you see the supposed top of the Rangers rotation in Darvish, Perez, and Robbie Ross, and they give up 24 runs in a 3-game series. Really, really different tales of the tape right there. I think that the Rangers lineup may be better, but it's overmatched because of the A's pitching is so good. And that's why the A's have won the last 7 matchups in Arlington. Well, now it's called a Global Life Ballpark. But the A's the A's seem to play well there, and they like playing against the Rangers because that's been the team that they've been competing with at the top of the AL West division the last 2 years. And they knew they had to come back, like you said, and revenge a 3-game sweep at O.co, and they did exactly that, taking 3 games in convincing fashion. Now they're going to head on to Boston for a 3-game series to end the road trip. But the Texas part of this road trip, the opening stand, very well. You take 5 of 7 against 2 teams in your division. I think you couldn't ask for anything more, especially with the sweep of the Rangers going up 3 games in the AL West now.
And how good do the A's have to be feeling? Second best road team in the AL. 12-4. When you're playing that good of ball on the road, you know O.co will take care of itself. So they hit Boston. As a ball club, how does a team perform better on the road than at home?
Yeah, and that's usually not the case for the A's. They usually like playing at home better because it's a pitcher's ballpark, and the A's have had better pitchers than hitters over the last couple of years, really the last century, if you want, not century, but last 10 years, decade, that's what I meant to say. But the A's, I think they'll get, like you said, they'll get that O.co home
field. It's only inevitable.
Yeah, home field advantage coming towards them soon. But right now, the A's, their game transfers to any ballpark because
that's big.
They run the platoon and they focus on pitching. So any team can throw it a righty or lefty, and I feel like the A's still have an advantage because of their depth and the guys they play. And I know I was listening to Baseball Tonight the night when Darvish was pitching, and Kirkchin and the other analysts brought up how the A's 1-25 are deeper than any team in the MLB, and they use their 25th guy more than other teams will use their 20th guy. The A's,
that's a great point.
Yeah, the A's focus on depth, and it's really seen because their 25th guy will play more games than really almost half the other teams. Like, their starters will play. I mean, it's just really interesting to see how Bob Melvin manages these lineups and gets everyone playing time, gets everyone confidence. And the pitchers, if they keep dealing like they are right now, the A's are really going to be one of the top teams in the West.
You can predict, coming All-Star break, are they starting to run away from Texas? Because it's talent-wise, and when you look at Texas's batters on paper, they're hefty. But right now, are the A's hitters performing better than Texas. We already know their staff's better and their bullpen is. And so if the whole train is running and this ball club is playing better than Texas, is there a shot that they start to run away?
They've got to take advantage of it right now because the Angels are historically slow starters, even though they're playing decent right now, only 3.5 back. The Rangers are dealing with a lot of injuries, guys like Profar, Holland, guys like their starting catcher, because they're having to play Arencibia way too much. But the Rangers are having...
Kaczynski?
Yeah. No, he's on a different team, I think, now.
Sorry, I just threw out.
No, it's okay. It's okay. But anyways, they got their backup third baseman, Kevin Kuzmanoff. He's on the DL now. So the Rangers are having a lot of players hit the DL. And now is the time for the A's, who are relatively healthy, minus their A.J. Griffin and Jared Parker. I almost said Tommy John, because they both have Tommy John. But yes, the A's are relatively healthy. So you've got to take advantage of the slow starts from the Rangers and Angels and really put this foot down in this division and really run away with it. And I think the A's have the ability to do that because of their pitching and their depth. Right now, like you said, you touched about it in the opening talking about the A's. Jesse Chavez has been the unsung hero. He's got a 1.89 ERA. He's 2-0, should be 4-0.
Wow.
Because the offense didn't pick him up in the other two games. He's got 41 strikeouts and a whip of 95.95. What I like about Jesse Chavez is he only has eight walks to 41 strikeouts. He throws the ball over the plate and he's forcing the hitters to make solid contact to get on base. And that's a theme throughout the A's rotation.
Yeah.
Throw strikes.
And his whole repertoire, he can throw strikes at any count. He'll throw any pitch at any count. And anytime you got that wicked of a cutter, a hitter's gotta be thinking in the back of their mind, okay, I gotta be looking for this if it's a 2-strike count. Or at least be thinking about it. He's nasty. He's got nasty stuff. And he's their number 3 starter, which makes it even more unbelievable. Probably, I don't want to be too radical, but I think that Jay Chav is the best 3 starter in baseball.
Yeah, right now he's pitching like it. We just have to see how he holds up over a course of a season, because he's been a bounce around the league reliever for many teams. I think he's been on 7 teams in 6 years. So, I mean, he hasn't really found a place. But right now, the A's trusted him enough to throw him in the starting rotation once Parker went down. And now that Griffin's down, Chavez has locked up that third spot. No doubt about it. He's going to be key for this team's success throughout the season. And he's pitching like one of the best 3 starters in all of Major League, because he has a 1.89 ERA. The guy's dealing. He did it again last night. Only 1 hit through 7 innings and only 1 walk. Can't ask for anything more from a 3 starter. And that's just really the theme of the A's. They have players who step up when needed, even if they're guys that really no one's heard about. One thing that I do want to talk about, from switching over to the batting side of things, to the offensive side, Derek Barton in our weekly watch, he was batting .77 last show. Now he's up to .146. So Derek Barton's starting to get on base a little bit more.
Seven
hits in 48 at-bats. And Josh Reddick, a guy that we were hard on the last couple of weeks, is now up to .241, so he's starting to get some confidence, and that's all was started from the Astros series 2 weeks ago, and he's starting to carry that over now.
Starting to gel. What's the main thing going forward that if you could take away? There's not too many things to improve as they're rolling right now in first place. What's one thing that you'd like to see Oakland slightly improve on?
Well, the bullpen, of course, is definitely the main thing that the A's need to improve on. Luke Gregerson's starting to scare me a little bit. I thought he was going to be the nastiest guy in the bullpen, but he's getting batted around a little bit too hard. And then Doolittle doesn't have confidence in his changeup or his slider or his new curveball, so he's really just throwing all fastballs. And you can't, even though you have a 96, 97 mile per hour fastball, major league hitters love that speed, and they've really lit up Sean Doolittle last couple of games. I think he has a 15 ERA in his last 4 appearances, so that's not something I want to see from Doolittle, but I know those guys will get around. They're veterans, and they've done this before the past couple of years. So, I mean, that's one thing that I'd like to see change. If I had to say one more point where I think the A's can really be the best team, is if they stay healthy, because we need Jed Lowry to stay healthy. We need Yoenis Cespedes to stay healthy. We need Coco Crisp to stay healthy. If those 3 guys can stay on the field and contribute, I think the A's can go as far as, I don't want to be radical, but as far as really any team could go.
At least they were where they were at last year.
Exactly, because Coco Crisp is the engine to this offense and this team. You need him at top of the order almost every day. The numbers with Cespedes in the lineup and the numbers without him, it tells no tale that the A's need him in that 3 or 4 spot every day. And Jed Lowrie, even though he doesn't play a great defensive shortstop, he's a very good switch hitter up top of that order, and he plays fundamental baseball. And I think the A's, those are the three guys where I think, well, and Josh Donaldson, if you want to throw in just another player. But if those three or four guys can stay healthy throughout the season, this A's team has the potential to be dangerous.
That's big, and I love the platoon that Melvin goes with too. The Norris-Jaso combo has been working well. I like what he's got going there. But those hitters, I think, yeah, if they stay healthy, look out for Oakland. Kirkson's on it.
Moving over to the other side of the bay, the San Francisco Giants also in first place in the division. You know, you've got to be happy about that, taking the last two from San Diego.
That was big after dropping the first. And they swept Cleveland. That was also huge. Hitting took that dip we saw in the series prior to the Dodgers. And now this is where the Giants sit atop of their division, but they take the road trip of death now. And so whenever you got to go to at Atlanta, at Pitt, and then at LA for 4, I'd call that the road trip of death. So right now they're sitting pretty. After this road trip is completed, we'll see where we're talking, but this is not going to be good. At least you're getting it going to Atlanta where it's not too incredibly hot. When you got to go to Atlanta and it's just scorching out there, that will kill you and eat you up, especially with the tomahawk chalk. But the problem is, you go to Atlanta, your back half of your rotation is taking the ball. Lincecum, yeah. Vogey, and Bumgarner. And Bumgarner has not looked himself at all, as he's given up the second most hits in the major league. So we'll see. I like how they've been playing so far, but this is going to be the true test. This is top of the cream competition in the NL.
Yeah, Atlanta's a very good squad. 17-9 overall, 9-3 at home. The one thing that I noted, like you said, the back of the rotation is starting for San Francisco, and Hudson just missed that start against his former team because he pitched last night and almost threw a complete game.
He might be one of the greatest free agent signings.
Yeah, 4-1 right now, almost threw another complete game. Hudson's been dealing for the Giants, and that's why they won 3-2 last night. But yeah, you're taking on Atlanta, Pittsburgh, and LA Dodgers, three teams that have the potential to go to the playoffs and even make a run of themselves. Right now, Atlanta's in first. Pittsburgh is kind of struggling, 10-17, but you know they've got the weapons to do it with Gerrit Cole, Andrew McCutchen, and the guys over there in Pittsburgh. So, yeah, tough 10-game road trip here starting for the Giants. If they can keep that bullpen healthy and really pitching the way they are right now, I think the Giants have a very good chance because the offense is starting to show some life again. We saw the pop from Pagan and Posey starting to get more homers like they were in the first couple days of the season. Michael Morse, we saw him take batting practice. The guy's an animal.
Can we just talk about that for one quick minute? From the field level, watching professional baseball players take BP, it's effortless. That was kind of a choppy word there. Effortless.
That effortless word wasn't effortless for you.
Exactly. For them. It's crazy. They hit bombs.
Yeah, Michael Morse took it almost to the glove.
Crazy. Hitting it nearly out of the stadium. You got, you know, concession people prepping, cleaning out the bleachers, walking around, nearly getting hit by flying balls. And it's just not the hitters taking it yard. And I'm sure this is with many other teams. There's a couple times that we saw Bum, and there might have been one other, Vogey, that went deep. And it just shows you're incredible to make it to the professional level.
Yeah, and these guys aren't even swinging hard. That's the thing. Yeah. It's such light hacks that they're taking. Like, we were watching the pitchers swing, and Bumgarner was barely even swinging. He'd flip it and go 320 opposite field. So these guys have extreme pop, and we've seen it so far throughout the Giants' regular season even. Going from batting practice to the season, they've hit a lot more homers this year, even at AT&T Ballpark, which is figured to be a pitcher's park. And
it's been surprising.
No home runs because it's so cold there at night and the ball doesn't travel. It's such a big park. But the Giants are up top of the major leagues in home runs due to the fact that Bumgarner's hit one, Morse has hit a couple, and now Posey's starting to join along and hit some homers. This team has got some pop, and if they can bring that to Atlanta and Pittsburgh, and then go down to LA Dodgers, where they played the Dodgers well this season already. This could be a turning point in the season, and where you're looking at the Giants taking that next leap towards getting ready for the playoffs. If you can prove yourself in this 10-game road trip, then that gives you the momentum to get really establish yourself as one of the best teams in the NL, bouncing back from last year's poor season.
Terrible, yeah. If they take six, I think that'd be successful. If you can go 6-4, they're not as good nearly as Oakland is on the road. But if you can take six, that I think that'd be very successful, because the Giants have beaten the Dodgers in the last two series. You're going to LA for four, coming off 6-3 in Atlanta, 3 in Pitt. Travel all the way, that's a long way. A lot of miles logged. You might be out of gas for those last four. If they can get six, they lose four, I think that'd be a successful road trip.
Yeah, I think the Dodgers series is the most important on this trip, of course, because it's your rival. It's the team that you're going to be battling against for the NL West crown. And then let's fast forward to that series starting May 8th. You're going to have Beckett versus Vogelsong. You'd have to say advantage Beckett, but yes. You never know. Then you're going Ryu versus Bumgarner, another great matchup against two great lefties.
Ryu right now.
But like you said, Bumgarner hasn't really pitched too well this season, so...
Then this next one scares me.
Kane versus Kershaw. Kershaw, of course, back. Top that pitching rotation.
Advantage Kershaw. Kane doesn't even have a W yet on the season.
And then you're going Greinke versus Hudson, which could be a very good...
That's probably the best matchup of the
I mean, the series. Dodgers throw out four good starters, and you're going to see all of them in that series against them later in May.
That's not what you're looking forward to, especially if this is a down road trip the start of it in Atlanta and against Pitt. I can understand losing two in Atlanta, but if you lose two in Pitt, who's struggling right now at 10-17, that hurts you.
Yeah. And
you got to win that series at least.
I agree. I think that the Giants have to win the series against Pittsburgh, because they're not throwing any of their guns like Gerrit Cole or guys like that. They're throwing Morton, who's 0-4, then they're throwing Compton, who's 0-1, a new pitcher in the majors. So I think the Giants have got to take at least two of them. I think the Giants are looking for a sweep in Pittsburgh, but the start of that road trip and the end of that road trip are going to be very, very telling of what the rest of this season might look like for the Giants. Even though it's the first month of the season, I think it's a very important road trip for the Giants.
I think it is too, because you could dip down into third place in the division after this road trip if it goes poorly, and that's exactly what happened last year. They had a nice little quick start, boom, things tanked fast, and so. Big road trip. That's all it sums up. If you can pitch well, keep the bullpen rolling, I think the Giants will be just fine. Clutch hitting's been what they've been thriving off of. Good pitching in the bullpen. That's all you need. This is the Temple of Swan at radio.dominican.edu. We'll be right back to wrap things up with the final show. Stay with us, everybody. We're back at the Temple of Swan on radio.dominican.edu, concluding up our last show. We're going to get into the mock draft. Only 6 days away, less than a week. A lot of anticipation. And I know me and Temple were ticked off a little bit how it got moved back this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's supposed to be last weekend, and now we have to wait a full 2 weeks after. I think it's been, the NFL's really just been kind of drugging along now, waiting for this draft to happen, because that's the key thing in the offseason. After you get past those major free agent signings, the draft is huge, and what every fan looks forward to for the next season for their team, and especially for the Raiders and Niners, who have expectations to be better than they were last year. The draft is huge, and you want to get young guys in earlier and let them really get acclimated with the weather, whatever, with the culture of the team. But now they're having to wait an extra 2 weeks to get drafted. I mean, it's really just dragging along. So, I mean, it's exciting to see the draft, and I'm really going to still be looking forward to it when it comes next week. But I agree, it's just been too long to wait in this offseason for the draft.
Does that hurt anybody besides the players or the owners? Can you over-scout?
I think everyone's over-scouting. I think they're all fine. Like, every scout, GM, and owner are finding flaws in players that they probably wouldn't have found.
Be kicking just themselves exactly. At the end of the day. Being so saying, we found too many little things about this guy, which we were high on, and now we got off and let him drop in the draft, and boom.
Yeah, so it seems like every prospect has a flaw that might hurt them. What was that?
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
That sounded like a scream in the background. It was a squeak from the mic stand. Wow.
But yeah, so I agree. I think that every prospect in this draft has their flaws have been talked about because of the time in which they've had to work out or they've gotten their film watched by many of the scouts and GMs. So I think that's one thing, but it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out, because I think after pick one, there's like a gray cloud over what's going to happen next in the draft.
There's
and even with pick one, because it might be end up being traded for that number one pick. So you never know. I think this whole draft, more than any that I could remember in recent memory, this draft has really been confusing to follow. And the mock drafts that I've seen have all been varied from.
They've shuffled around probably the most I've seen. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. And there's been so many of them because of the 2 week
delay.
So, I mean, I've seen five different drafts from like each scout or analyst or person or whatever you may have, an expert in quotations, that have differed from every time because of so much being said, so many rumors being said, so many different things needed from each team. And I have no clue what's going to happen in this draft, which I guess is exciting in a way, but it's also kind of scary because you don't know who's going where. I mean, Clowney does look like the number one pick, but you don't know what team's going to pick him.
This seems like there is a consensus from the fans' perspective and, I don't know, some of the analysts, that there is one guy that should be the number one pick. Should be. And I think it should be Jadeveon Clowney. I think if you're up there in agreement, we think the same along that line. But he may not get selected number one. There's a lot of times where, okay, there's an agreement of who's going to go number one, and he goes number one. That's not the case. Everyone's saying Clowney's got the best talent to be a number one pick, but he may not go number one. And who knows? It's all about the right fit. He may not go number two. So we'll see what happens as he shuffles up and down draft boards of different people or who the Texans decide to go with. And as a fan of the Raiders, as you are, with number five, I asked you this probably a couple weeks ago, who would you want? Has your mind changed on any player or particular that you would want the Raiders to draft if he's there?
The Raiders just need someone who's going to be good for 10 to 15 years. So there's so many choices that the Raiders can make because they have so many needs that really any pick I would be excited for if they were like on top 10 of the draft board. Because last year the Raiders picked Hayden, who they said was number one on their draft board, but wasn't even top 10. Man, the weather is getting to us. But anyways, I think that if the Raiders, what I would envision is them picking either Sammy Watkins if he's there, Khalil Mack if he's there. But if both of those guys are gone, which they very well might be, then just an offensive tackle like Greg Robinson would be nice, or a guy along those lines. The Raiders really can't mess up.
That's who Kipe and McShay have for Robinson going to the Raiders. But if I don't want to overrate Sammy Watkins, man, but he's my favorite prospect in this draft. I love Clowney. I'd take him number one in a heartbeat, but I love Sammy Watkins. I think he's going to be good, and I hope I'm not overrating him, but he's got Percy Harvin and Moore written all over him.
Yeah.
And when Harvin's healthy, he's pretty dangerous. And so.
Yeah, the thing about Watkins is he can be a kick returner like Percy Harvin is.
Yeah.
And he could be a legitimate outside threat stretching the field like Calvin Johnson or a guy of that stature. So that's why Watkins has really created all the buzz around him and become a lock to be in that top five picks. You just don't know which order. Does he fall down to five to the Raiders, or does he get claimed number two, number three, maybe even number one? A lot of teams seem like they like Sammy Watkins, and I know the Raiders like him because in the press conference Reggie McKenzie had today, he said if Watkins is there, we're not passing on him. I don't know if that's just a
I think just that's a bluff. Smart. Yeah, it could be, but
I think a lot of teams are of similar mindset that if Watkins is there, they're not going to pass on him. And I feel the same about Khalil Mack. Even though he played for Buffalo, he proved in games against Ohio State and other top-of-the-line teams that he could play linebacker in the NFL. He has very good instincts, very good speed. And I think Khalil Mack, if he's there for the Raiders alongside Sammy Watkins, I'd go, like you said, Sammy Watkins first. Well, let's start from the top of my draft border.
Okay.
Jadeveon Clowney is the number one prospect, I think, for me. Even though there's some rumors about him taking plays off, I think that'll change in the NFL because of the competition level he has to play against. So he's number one. Sammy Watkins, number two. The Raiders can use that outside threat. They could really use a number one receiver alongside James Jones and Denarius Moore, Rod Streeter, guys of that stature. And then number three is Khalil Mack. If in that order, if any of those guys are there, I think the Raiders would hit a home run in the first round of this draft if they can get any of those three players.
And I'll say something about Khalil Mack. If Clowney has tapped out at his potential and for some reason he does not pan out and his motor is just not there to hack it in the NFL, I hope that's not the case. He's way too dang good to not be a great NFL football player. But if it comes down, I will say, and I don't want to be positive about this, but Khalil Mack might have the best upside as a linebacker in this draft.
He's
his first step is quicker than Clowney. Clowney is bigger. He's more explosive. But what Khalil Mack is more fluid. And when you have fluidity and you can move your hips and you can get around blocks and you can really pursue down on the ball carriers and get after the quarterback like Khalil Mack can, I will take Khalil Mack in a heartbeat.
And
I wouldn't be upset if they took him over Watkins.
Me either.
I think he's that good.
Yeah, and Mack has risen up the draft boards over the last couple of months because of that flexibility, versatility, like you said. Before this whole two-month, three-month-long process that has really become the draft, it was Anthony Barr, Khalil Mack. Those guys were seen as equal, with maybe even Anthony Barr being ahead of him. Now Barr has fallen out of the top 20 maybe, and Khalil Mack's risen to be a top three pick. And that says a lot from a guy from Buffalo who didn't get a lot of
recognition.
This
senior season.
Yeah, playing in a major conference like the Pac-12 or the SEC. So, I mean, that does say a lot for how good of a player he is. And I think him being that hybrid defensive end, offensive, outside linebacker that he is, I think Khalil Mack would be the perfect fit for the Raiders. Even though they have a decent group of linebackers, you're not going to have a guy so young, so talented like him, and I think it complements the Raiders' defense extremely well. So I think that's the number one guy they've got to target, along with Jadeveon Clowney and Sammy Watkins. If they can get any of those three guys, which they might all be gone by that time, then I think it's a successful first round. Now, I did want to pose one question to you about the Raiders before we move on to the Niners.
All right.
What do you say Clowney's gone, say Watkins is gone, say Mack, and let's just the fourth pick, let's say Robinson's gone. So those guys are all gone in the top four, no matter the order. Do you think it's smart if the Raiders trade back?
Yes.
And I agree more.
I would say absolutely. You can go deeper. There's all your number three home run hitters gone off the board. Why not get an extra pick? You know that people are going. People are going to want Johnny Football if he's not gone in the top four or top five. So Raiders can get a good hefty trade value for their number five pick if those three players are gone. And I wouldn't take a risk on anybody at number five.
Yeah.
Risks are not what you need in this draft. After all the great moves that they have made in the offseason, get someone who's solid, and you can do that by trading back because there will be a team. There's always a team that wants to hop into the top 10.
Yeah.
I would trade back.
I agree. I couldn't agree more with you. I think the Raiders need multiple players out of this draft. They need multiple home runs. So if guys like Clowney, Watkins, and Mack are off your draft board, it makes sense to trade back. You're still going to have a first-round pick, but then you also might acquire a second-round pick with it. If you can get...
Dude, now, the price of one
exactly,
right there.
Now you're going to have three picks in the first two rounds. There's more of a chance to get three good players on your team, three good young players onto a roster that needs youth, that needs those guys who can hit the home run and be playmakers both on both sides of the ball. That's the best thing that the Raiders could ask for.
Absolutely. I think it's unprecedented how there's so many guys that turn out to be great NFL football players that don't get drafted in the first round. Second, third, fourth, fifth,
sixth. Yeah, that's where drafts can be made.
Yeah, talent is everywhere. It's all about how players respond to coaches, how they develop as their player.
Yeah, and what player scheme they're playing in.
Yeah, scheme is huge. Trade back. You can definitely find talent in the second round.
And I think in this draft in particular, there's a lot of players who won't be drafted in that first round who are very good prospects. You can get guys in the second and third round that might have been first round draft picks in the last couple of years because of how deep this player pool is. Yeah, there's no Andrew Luck or guys like of that nature, but there are guys who could come and contribute on a football team later in the round. So I think in a dream situation here, like let's just picture perfect world here. All right. Raiders would get either Clowney, Watkins, or Mack, but if not, they trade back and they get maybe a 20th pick and also a second-round pick added on to their one that they already have. That way they have three picks in the first two rounds.
That'd be huge. They might even get – they'll get more than that, too. They might get a second and a third.
Because it wouldn't be just a second, but I was just starting.
And I hear you. That's huge.
If they could pull that – because like you said, a lot of teams are going to want Johnny Manziel, are going to want to jump into that top five. And if you could just hold off long enough and create enough buzz with that fifth pick, then I think it should be easier to trade. Then you being the Raiders, you should hop on that right away and get multiple picks for the price of one.
If that went down, this is what I would do if I was Oakland. I don't know if this would work. I'd bluff like I'm taking Manziel.
Yeah.
I'd say we're taking him. Absolutely. You want him, you have him, but we're taking him if you're not going to trade.
Which is why I think
and
they
people will
exactly.
Bite.
Why I think they've because the Raiders have hyped up Manziel a little bit. They've said that they like him to be the best strategy. Yeah, the best quarterback. They brought him in to visit like many other teams did. But I think that, like you said, you've got to bluff and make people believe that you're going to pick Manziel so that they'll want to jump you so that you don't get him first. And I think that's a great strategy and why you see so many teams inviting guys like Manziel, Bridgewater, Bortles to their camps to really create buzz around what might be a bluff.
I think that's the number one thing is to create buzz. Fans might be like, what in the heck are we bringing three quarterbacks to scout? We don't want a quarterback. Well, the Raiders know they don't want a quarterback now that they have Shaw, but they need to create the hype that if those players that they want get taken, boom, you can fall back to your backup plan. Okay, well, we had these guys. We're raving about them. Why not? Yeah, we're going to take them here. Somebody bite on our bait and trade up for him.
Yeah, and I think the Raiders can get that quarterback that they want, and either if they trade back, they can get that quarterback with that extra pick in either the second or third round, because there's a lot of decent quarterbacks who might pan out in your system that you can get in the second or third round, whether it be David Carr, Fales, Garoppolo, guys like that who might not make it to the first round, but could be very decent quarterbacks when picked in the second or third round.
And I don't know if there is a quarterback. I know for a fact that there's not a quarterback in Luck, RG3, or Wilson's caliber. So when you don't have that, there's some question in the air to reach on a quarterback that early. So the three quarterbacks that you just listed can pan out pretty dang well if they're taken later in the draft than the guys who were taken early in the first round. There's nobody that's in that higher echelon in the league of quarterbacks.
Yeah, so why reach, like
why?
You said?
Why?
Because
there will be teams that go for it, but
it's
not the Raiders.
Yeah, it's a quarterback league, and if you know that you're not going to get it in this year's draft, then just take a chance in the second or third round. Don't waste a first-round pick on what might not be the quarterback of the future for your team. which is what we saw in Gino Sanchez.
Mark.
I combined both of them. Oh,
that's cool.
Well, because both of them
that's
are.
Cool how you just did that. The ultimate fail from the Jets' two quarterbacks is Gino Sanchez. Gino Smith and Mark Sanchez combined.
I don't know why. Yeah, I don't know
why. That was awesome. Oh, that was on accident, but that was awesome. I just gave an air five to Temple.
Gino Smith, Mark Sanchez. I was picturing them both. But, yeah, the Jets reach, and you've seen what they've gotten out of that. Two failed attempts. Well, not we can't really count Smith as a fail yet, but he seems
he's
to be working.
Way.
Exactly.
Yeah, that does not look
the
good.
Bills did it last year with E.J. Manuel. They jumped ahead of what they should have been and got a quarterback who they might have reached for. And that's just going to create an never-ending cycle of you not getting the quarterback that you need to win games.
Every year, there are teams that have the terrible years, and they think we need a franchise quarterback. And each year, there's a bunch of hype from the quarterbacks that did so well in college to try to replace this. And you see this time and time again, that these rookie quarterbacks cannot hack it. The defenses are way too different and more talented in the NFL than they are in college. The offensive schemes that they run in college are a lot more different than what the offensive coordinators are asking them to run in the NFL. And when you reach, you're going to get burned. And we've seen these organizations, the Browns, the Bills, keep reaching for these quarterbacks, and it does not pan out. Browns try to go after Colt McCoy. Then they try to go after Weeden. It just does not work. And so I think you reach on a quarterback, you're taking your own gamble, but you might shoot yourself in the foot. But
did you see the Browns sign Vince Young and Tyler Thigpen today?
Yeah, that
they just keep bringing in quarterbacks. I don't know how you sign two quarterbacks in one day.
It's just like a crapshoot. They're saying, okay, maybe we'll get lucky with one, but I don't know about
and then there's
Thigpen and
speculation
Young.
That they might draft Manziel. So let's bring in four or five quarterbacks on the roster before our first practice even begins. I don't know.
Create that competition, I guess. But that kind of shows that they're taking a quarterback.
Yeah.
They want QB compo. In spring.
I like that. QB compo.
Yeah, a little QB compo. A lot of people hate that I abbreviate words, but it's just kind of ingrained in me. I've been doing it since I was young.
Well, jump. Let's make that. Let's see if you can really enhance on that. I don't even know what to say about that. But anyways, jumping over to the other side of the bay with the Niners. Who's your dream pick where the Niners are slotted? It's kind of harder to predict.
Dream pick?
It's kind of harder to predict what the Niners are going to do because they're so late in the first round. But there's been a lot of speculation that they trade up and get a key guy because they have so many picks to dispose of. What's your dream pick in that first round? Do they trade up or do they stay where they are?
Dream pick. This here we go. I'll give you a scenario. If Kyle Fuller or Verrett somehow fall to 30, that's my dream pick. If there's a chance to trade up without – yeah, if there's a chance to trade up and get Gilbert or Denard, if they have both fallen past 15 or 16, then that's my dream pick. But if they say Gilbert and Denard get selected but Fuller or Verrett are still on the board at 30, boom, there's no need to trade up. Select one of those guys. I'm high on either of those two corners. I'd be completely happy with that. But – realistically, all those corners could be gone.
Yeah, what do you think about the situation that has the Niners trading up to get a wide receiver like Sammy Watkins or like Mike Evans? Because I've heard rumors that the Niners
they go
might,
big.
Yeah, the Niners might be interested in getting to that top three to get I've heard Clowney as well, but getting into that top three to get a huge home run hitter, what do you think about that? Because I know I like your plan of trading to the middle of the first round to get guys like you said, but what do you think about going big or going home?
If they pulled that, I would be in full 100% support. This team is at a stage where, you know, yes, it's great to build for the future, but you know what? Time is kind of knocking. Getting to three NFC championships and back-to-back-to-back seasons, you know, it's time to win now. If you need one player to really solidify your offense or defense and going after Sammy Watkins or a Mike Evans, you know what? I'm all for it. Go for it, because if you have the talent you have right now, because there's the slew of contracts next year and the year after that, that this team is looking like it will not be the same core. We saw what happened this offseason. No more Whitner, no more Brown, no more Rodgers. Little pieces get plucked because you can't afford all of them. They're too good. And so I'd be on board. If they want to go big, you know what? Take the dive off the cliff and go big.
Yeah, And that's I also agree with that thinking, too. I think the Niners are in a very comfortable state and where they are in the draft right now. Even though they pick at number 30, they have so many picks that they can trade up with, or they can stand pat and trust in the fact that their scouts are going to bring in that one player that they need to take them to the next level, which is winning a Super Bowl. Because
that's the main goal right now for them.
The Niners, that's their only goal, is winning the Super Bowl. They don't want to get to the Super Bowl. They want to win the Super Bowl. And they really are maybe one or two pieces away from being that team that can compete in the NFC and then go to the Super Bowl and win it. So I also agree that the Niners might want to get into that top three in the first round, maybe give away four or five picks that they have just to get that one key player to really push them atop and make them a legit Super Bowl contender.
Yeah, and if there's a perfect situation to do it with the slew of picks that they have, it's this year. They have so many. And so you can go two options. You could trade up and you could get rid of them, or
and the Niners don't need 10 to 11, 12 guys to come in through this draft class. They need 3 to 4 guys, one being huge for this team, but just 3 or 4 guys that can really contribute right away, because we've seen it so many times with the Niners. They'll bring in guys, they'll draft guys, but they're not going to even make their team because they're so deep and so talented of a roster that it really, they only have maybe 2 or 3 spots even available right now.
Yeah.
So you've got to get that one guy who's going to contribute right away.
And right now, I'd probably say the probability of them doing that is probably like 20%. I'd love to see them do it, but that organization with Balke is, we need to have depth, because if there are going to be players that take off, we need to have these rookies be prepared. Even if they're not playing now this season, they'll be ready for when, you know, we can't afford certain players that are going to be key cogs. And you know what? They might not. What makes it really big that they may not go trade is Aldon Smith is the biggest bonehead in the NFL, and he can't get his act together. So now they might have to wait, and if they want to trade up maybe to mid-round or not trade up at all, because now they need a pick to spend on a rookie D-end to build him up. So, gosh dang it, Aldon Smith. Gosh. That was my rant. I can't.
What are you going to do?
I can't stand, especially when you have that much talent as an NFL player and the team you are playing for is a contender and you just want to F it all up. Not going to nearly drop that F-bomb on the radio, but you know what? What are you doing?
Yeah. Keep going.
Golly.
I couldn't agree more. I mean,
he's
one of the best pass rushers we've seen in the last decade.
He's dominant.
Exactly, and he plays for a great team, like you said. It's not like he's playing for the Browns or the Raiders in a team that hasn't won games. The Niners have been contenders the last 3 or 4 years, so it's... there's no excuse for him to go out and do what he's been doing lately. It's just...
he's wrecking his career, to tell you the truth, because there's not many GMs that put up with any of that. So,
and you can see the Niners are starting to get a little bit fed up, but they know what they have in Aldon Smith, and they're willing to just ride him one more run, and hopefully he doesn't do anything dumb like he's done the last couple of years. But
league's about to crack down on him, so it's all about if Aldon wants to get his act together and shape up, or be the worst downward spiral that the Niners have had in a while, especially being a great talent like he is. That was great draft talk, though, Temple.
That was. I mean, it gets me excited for next week. Where are you watching the draft at?
It does. You know what? Probably just in my apartment.
There you go.
Are you watching at home?
I don't know. I think it's...
are you going to a draft party?
It's next Thursday, right? It's next Thursday?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm always used to it being on Saturday.
Or is it when?
It is next Thursday.
Okay, next Thursday.
I think
that's so weird how they break it
up, too. Yeah, 4:30 Thursday.
The first round is just Thursday, and then they break it up between the whole weekend.
I didn't like that. I liked when I was a younger kid waking up, first round, first pick of the draft. I miss those days, but
now
times have changed.
Now it's just one.
Now it's Goodell days.
Goodell days.
I was with Tagliabue.
Oh, I remember him, Paul Tagliabue. That was back when we were youngins.
Yeah.
But yeah,
good times.
I don't know where I'm watching the draft, but I know I'll be tuned in to pick number 5. Then I might drift off.
That's kind of how a lot of fans are starting to get.
It takes
so long.
Isn't
now?
Isn't it 10 minutes per pick for the first
10
round?
10 or 15.
That
I don't know.
Crazy.
I can't tell you. But
so it's going to take an hour to run through the first
long.
5.
And if you got trades, then you got more time.
Yeah.
And I know what you mean. You just want to know, all right, my team's on the clock. You got all my attention. Boom, picks made. All right. I'm going to wait till, when do they have it in the second round? Okay, I know when to come back.
Exactly. But
I'm with you there.
I mean, the draft is fun to watch, and I like watching the highlights to see where all the players went in the first couple of rounds.
Yeah.
But watching it in person that first round, it's tough to stay there the whole time because it's just so long, each pick. But we'll see. I mean, it's going to be a huge first round for the Raiders, huge draft in general for the Raiders, and I think the Niners as well, because they're looking for that one or two pieces to really put them atop and get them past the Seahawks in the NFC West this season. So huge draft for the Raiders and Niners. Make sure you tune in to, not tomorrow, next Thursday.
Yeah.
Because we're finally going to be able to draft.
I'll be big. Hey, quick sleeper, though, before we end this whole shenanigan here. Pierre Desir, Lindenwood College in Missouri.
I've never heard of him.
Corner, 6'1", 200. And this is what stuck. He was running a 4.5, but he broad jumped 11 feet. When I heard that, I was like, okay, that's real far. And then they compared it to an Olympic athlete. They're jumping 11.3. This guy jumped 11 feet. Olympic athlete jumping 11 feet, 3 inches. My goodness.
Where do they have him going? Because I never even heard of this guy.
Third round.
Okay.
Around there. So, yeah, he's a sleeper, you know.
That's crazy intangible.
So we'll see. He didn't play D1 ball, but I just saw a little feature on him. I was like, my goodness, Pierre, you can play.
So
if you strap on a Niner uniform and we get you later, I'd be happy.
There you go.
But sleeper of the draft right there. I'll throw it out there. You take it, man. You take the wrap up, man. This is the last show. Take the wrap up, baby.
Well, it's been a good run this season. We've called some basketball games, called some lacrosse games.
Dude, this year has been incredible.
I don't know what we have in store for next year if we're inked to those basketball contracts.
Dude, come on, man. We got to be inked. Stu, if you're listening, we got to be inked, man.
Because I know we got the radio show in written text form, but he didn't say anything about next year's basketball. But
dude, let's go quick overview.
Do it.
When we came here, I didn't even know we could do a radio show. And so when we were in radio, I'm just going to give you a backstory how Temple and I met. There's a weird girl named Desert Rose. Not going to say her real name on the air. Her DJ name is Desert Rose. Not throwing her under the bus at all. Just kind of odd talking about Miley Cyrus way too much. I'm not a Miley Cyrus fan. I don't really follow her whatsoever. So you know what? I saw another dude in the class because there's not too many dudes in the class.
Yeah, there's probably like three or four.
And I go over and you know what? Let's talk to this guy. He looks like he's got a little light blue shirt on, repping some basketball shorts. I was like, dang, man, maybe he's into sports. We'll see what's up with him. Next thing you know, we meet, decide to do a dual radio show. There were some doubts that it would be hard because there's something called rookies and veterans. We were the rookies.
And to said, do... Yeah, 2 hours was too long.
2 hours for two rookies is a hefty task. And you know what? We took it on. And it's been awesome. And that was how we met. But just to go, what do you think about the broadcast we've been able to do for B-ball and all that? And even getting our feet wet with lacrosse? I mean, that's been nuts.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Pretty crazy year, like you said. We took on the task of doing a two-hour radio show, which 1 hour seemed long when he was first talking about it. But then we did it together and did 2 hours. Really nailed it. And just randomly got selected one day because we got a call from Stu saying that we should do the basketball games because he liked how we talked about sports. And that came out of nowhere because I didn't even know that. I thought it was just him who did the basketball games. But now
me too.
He was running a three-crew team calling the basketball games. And that really, I think, got us comfortable being on air both during game situations, both on our shows, because now we don't even prepare for our shows. It's more just talking from what we see from games, just watching. And
yeah,
I mean, it's the basketball was probably the coolest experience for us over the, I mean, I'll speak for myself, but basketball was definitely the coolest experience, being there watching the team compete like they did, come second in both the regular season and conference tournament in the Pac West, the best season that they've had for the D2 era.
Kind of a cool year to come,
and we were part of that and saw all the accolades that this team got, and then the girls basketball team, the late season run that they had, can't shortchange them. That was also interesting to call and watch them, how they changed. I mean, it was just a good experience. Just our first year too, like you said, it didn't even know this was all possible, and it took one semester for us to do it.
I don't even think we could have asked for more. We took on a full load with school. You were running track. You'll be that captain next year running track. That'll be fun. And Dang, dude, that was more than I expected coming here. So radio.dominican.edu has been good to us. And you remember when we were DJ Ty and DJ Chops?
Ty and Chops.
Ty and Chops.
Bringing it back. Bring throwback it back Thursday.
Right to TBT. TBT. Hashtag Instagram.
Hashtag Instagram.
Yeah, dude. That was awesome. Yeah. It was sports relative.
And now we are the Temple of Swan, which I think we've agreed to keep our show
name. Yeah,
we're
going to keep that to wrap up the year.
So, yeah, we'll be coming back next year. I don't know what days, but we'll definitely put that on our Facebook page. It's been a good run. I know from Chops and Ty to Mike and Alex, we've had a great season. We'll be back next year at radio.dominican.edu. Thanks for...
Mike just hit the okie doke on everybody. He went with the mute. You can't get any better than that on the last show right there.
I wanted you to call it. Give us our last one.
No, I'm not calling it. I gave the intro. You're calling it, Temple.
And we are out for the Temple of Swan at radio.dominican.edu.
See you later.
Next fall, we will be back.
Woo!